we're doing on time, I think. Okay. We move on then from Palestine under the Greeks to Jewish independence under the Hasmoneans, 160 BC, down almost a century to 63 BC. We start out again with Antiochus IV, Antiochus Epiphanes, and the Abomination of Desolation. Antiochus IV had actually come to the throne by usurping the throne from his underage nephew in 175 BC. He tries, even harder than the earlier Seleucids had done, to unify this diverse empire by means of Hellenism. So he favors the Hellenistic Jews in Jerusalem, and they refound Jerusalem as Antiochia, or what we'd say Antioch today. He deposes the Orthodox high priest, a fellow named Onias III, for Onias's brother Jason, who was much more favorable to Hellenism. And that surely caused some problems, but nowhere near what the problems caused when he later deposes Jason for a Menelaus, who is not in the high priestly family, he's apparently a priest, who had bribed Antiochus to get the office. And Menelaus had offered a big price, but as it turns out, ironically, wasn't able to raise the money after Jason had already been deposed and such. But that's the danger of depending upon unpaid bribes, I suppose. Well, meanwhile, Antiochus is off fighting in Egypt, trying to get control of the Ptolemy side of the empire. Antiochus, like many of the guys who control these two big pieces anyway, had a desire to take the other big piece and get nearly as much empire as Alexander would have. So he goes down into Egypt, and in 168 BC, it looks like he's going to defeat the Ptolemies when the Romans show up. And a Roman fellow who had known Antiochus from maybe not childhood, but teenage years, I think they'd both been Antiochus had been a hostage in Rome at that point, comes to Antiochus and says, the Roman Senate says you need to move out of Egypt and go back home. And Antiochus says, I'll think about it. And the Roman pulls out his staff and draws a circle in the sand around Antiochus and says, stand there while you think about it. And so Antiochus does back down, and he's not happy then as he's coming out of Egypt, having been overawed, if you like, by the Romans. And he finds out that a rebellion is going on in Israel when he's headed into that area. Namely, it's Jason who has rebelled against Menelaus, etc. And so Antiochus IV decides to try to destroy Judaism. He forbids circumcision. He forbids observing the kosher food laws. He tries to destroy Scripture. He rededicates the temple to Zeus. And he considered himself, you remember, a manifestation of Zeus. Sets up a statue, which may have resembled himself. We don't have any pictures of the statue, and we don't know exactly what Antiochus looked like anyway. That sets off what we'll call the Maccabean Revolt. So we turn to look at the Maccabean Revolt, 167 BC to about 134. Well, the Seleucids have put down their opposition in Israel, they think, and the government, Seleucid government, then sends out officers to go through all the towns of Judea, enforcing Antiochus' decrees and commanding pagan sacrifice. When they get to the little village of Modin, there's an aged priest, Mattathias, there, and the whole village is brought out to do the pagan sacrifice. And one of the Jews in the village starts to sacrifice, and this aged priest, Mattathias, kills the guy. Well, that would be a pretty disastrous thing to do, except that there are more villagers there than the official and his troops. And so they kill the official and the troops, and naturally that's going to get back to headquarters fairly quick. And so Mattathias and his five grown sons call for an armed resistance and flee to the mountains, to the caves, etc. That's the origin of the revolt, That leads us to one of Mattathias' sons, Judah, the third son of Mattathias, had a military name, the Maccabee, meaning the hammer or the hammerer, so kind of like Stonewall Jackson or something of that sort, or Tippecanoe or one of those military names that generals sometimes get. Well, Judah then leads a military campaign and manages by ambush techniques and by knowing the terrain in a way that the Seleucids don't to destroy several Seleucid armies. The Seleucids basically are working in terms of a build-up, and they don't want to send more troops than they need, but they always underestimate how many they need. And so as they gradually build up, Judah succeeds, and as Judah begins to succeed, more and more Jews flock to his standards. So Judah's forces grow with the success, and they match the Seleucid escalation. Finally, we'll call them the Maccabees, the followers of Judah, take Jerusalem, except for the citadel, the main fortress. I don't think that's actually the Fortress Antonia that you would see in the New Testament time maps, but a predecessor to that. They take Jerusalem, pin up the remaining Seleucids and some of the Hellenistic Jews in the citadel. They cleanse the temple. Remember, it had been a site of worship of Zeus for a while here. And they rededicate the temple. And that is in December of 164 BC. And that becomes the origin of Hanukkah, or the Feast of Dedication. Meanwhile, Antiochus IV dies in 163. And Lysias takes over as regent for the person who's going to become king when he gets old enough. And Lysias would rather get out of this thing, so he offers peace terms that are acceptable to some of the very pious Jews, though not to the Maccabees, and so splits the opposition against himself. And so just a few years later, the Seleucid forces come back, and Judah and his forces, heavily outnumbered, Judah is killed in battle in 160 B.C. Well, that's not the end of Mattathias's kids. Judah was the third son, and there are still two sons left at this point out of the five. The other two have already died. One of these is Jonathan, and he will become ruler of Israel from 160 to 142, and the other one is Simon, and he will become ruler from 142 to 134. The Seleucid Empire by this point has been weakened by division over the question of the succession after Antiochus, and so Judah and Simon in their turn are able by diplomacy to gain strength until Judah, until the land of Judea becomes virtually independent. It turns out that both Jonathan in 142 BC and Simon in 134 BC are murdered by opponents, but not before Simon has gained the hereditary priesthood and the rule of Israel for his family. With Simon's death, then, his son comes to rule, and so when you've got two successive father-son things ruling, that can be counted as a dynasty. I probably could have counted it already from Jonathan, but the Hasmonean dynasty is typically dated then from 134 B.C., 1 to 63 B.C. The first guy is Simon's son, who has the slightly more complicated name, John Hyrcanus, and he rules from 134 to 104 B.C. Very successful. The Seleucid dynasty has become weak, etc., and John has become rather strong militarily. He is able to greatly expand the Judean territory. So he picks up the coastal cities, which had long been lost to the Jews. Remember, when they come back from Babylonian captivity, they basically settle in the hill country around Jerusalem, etc. So he takes the coastal cities. He takes the territory of the Edomites, Idumea, to the south, and the territory of the Sumerians, Samaria, to the north. And so becomes a very significant territory at this point. During his reign, 30 years, huh? We first hear in Josephus of the Pharisees and the Sadducees. And the Pharisees apparently had been in favor initially, but by making a suggestion that was not PC, if you like, by suggesting that John should resign the high priesthood because his mother gave birth to him while she was a captive, which made some suggestions on whether he was legitimate or not, he decided to go with the Sadducees instead. So the Sadducees kind of become the in party at that time, and they will be that off and on down to even New Testament times. Well, in 104 he dies, and one of his sons is Aristobulus, and he reigns for about a year. He kills several brothers to, I suppose, strengthen his take on the throne. That not uncommon, I'm afraid, among these kind of situations. And he takes the title king. So from Judah is just a general, if you like. Jonathan is a general, if you like. Simon is not only a general, but he's also the high priest, even though he belongs to priestly family, but he's not in the high priestly line, if you like. But now Aristobulus takes the title king, and his successor do not resign that title, if you like. But Aristobulus doesn't last long. He dies within a year from fear. You know, he's assassinated all these, killed all his brothers, from drink, and probably from disease of some sort. One of his brothers is still alive, had been in prison. And so when Aristobulus dies, Aristobulus's widow releases this brother, Alexander, from prison and marries him. So John Hyrcanus's widow and John Hyrcanus's brother, Aristobulus, then become the royal pair, if you like. And Alexander Janaeus, then, is the name of the younger brother, rules from 102 to 76 B.C. He continues expansion of the kingdom until it's nearly as big as that of David and Solomon. So we're getting a rather powerful local kingdom here that is really carved out of the Seleucid Empire, which has been falling apart all of this time. During his reign, the Pharisees revolt against him and call for the Syrians, that is the remnant of the Seleucids, to come in and help. And Alexander is about to lose when the Pharisees get second thoughts. Would it really be better to have the Syrians, the Seleucids, in control of the territory? So they defect back again. Well, Alexander wins, but has mixed feeling about the Pharisees. After all, yes, if they hadn't come back, he would probably have lost. But if they hadn't revolted in the first place, he wouldn't have ever gotten into the problem. So he crucifies a bunch of the Pharisees. Well, he dies in 76 B.C., and his wife, the one who had been Aristobulus's wife and then his wife, comes to be the ruling queen, short period for 75 to 67. Her name is Salome Alexandra. And she succeeds. She has two sons. And they're called Hyrcanus II. John Hyrcanus then would be Hyrcanus I. And Aristobulus II, okay? Hyrcanus is the milder and older of the two, and he's made high priest, and because Salome can't be high priest, and Aristobulus is given military command. Unfortunately, Aristobulus is the person who is very, what shall we say, ambitious, and he wants to rule. And when Salome Alexander dies in 66, we come to the crucial event which leads to the end of Hasmonean independence. She dies. She's succeeded by Hyrcanus II, who is supported by the Pharisees, but Aristobulus II, supported by the Sadducees, takes the throne away from him. Hyrcanus flees to a neighboring nation, opens a civil war, and calls on the Romans for aid. And at this point, the Romans are growing strong in the Middle East, if you like, Near East, I guess we'd call it, and they're anxious to come in and help out. Well, before we run on to that, then, we come back and look at the some of the features of this time period. And one of the important ones is the three groups that we hear about in Josephus and the New Testament, the Pharisees and Sadducees we hear about in both, and the Essenes, which we hear about only in the Josephus material. The origins of these three groups are somewhat obscure, but all three apparently rise during this period, the Maccabean period, so 168 to 63, a century or so. The Pharisees and the Essenes apparently arrive from the very pious group that joined with Judah in the Maccabean revolt, a group we call the Chassidim. The Chassid is a noun for one who is faithful to the covenant. You'll see rather regularly in the Hebrew, the Old Testament, Chesed, which from the perspective of a human towards God means faithfulness to the covenant. And the perspective of God to the humans, it also means faithfulness to the covenant, but that comes across as loving kindness, mercy, things of that sort, because the covenant is a merciful covenant, not something that the humans beat out the features of discussion with God or something of that sort. Well, a little bit about the Pharisees, the Sadducees, and the Essenes. Let's look first of all about their theology. We think the name Essene comes from Hasid. Okay, problem of Greek not really having a good H sound, and so lots of things get lost. So, in Hebrew you've got Hallelujah, and in Greek you've got Alleluia, etc. So we think that there's an argument over where that comes from. So if that's right, the Essenes are the faithful ones, okay? They're what we might call super Pharisees, okay? They go the Pharisees one better. And in fact, they decided that the temple was really ruled by people who were not sufficiently orthodox, and so they would no longer mess with the temple. In a great anachronism, we can say their view of the relationship of God's sovereignty to human responsibility is Calvinistic, okay? Understand, that's not a term in existence at that time. Their sources of authority, the Old Testament, but some secret books. And we think we now know what some of the secret books are. They would be things like the Manual of Discipline, the Book of Enoch, the Book of Jubilees, some of those kinds of works would probably fall in that category. We're not sure what their view about survival is. Some think that they believed in resurrection, which would not be terribly surprising. Some think that they believed in immortality of the soul, but not resurrection. So I put a question mark in that about over on that question in my notes here. They had a great emphasis on angels, and that seems to have come from Enoch and the Jubilees, where we get the names of a bunch of other angels and some history of their activity. Not quite as elaborate as Milton's Paradise Lost, but still a good bit of information there. And they had a great deal of emphasis on eschatology. Contrast those with the Pharisees. Their name, we think, comes from Parash, separate. Okay, so they were the separatists. Not really separatists compared with the Essenes, because they didn't leave society, but a great emphasis on ritual purity and on building a hedge about the law. The idea being, if you don't want people walking in your fields, you put a hedge around the thing that they can't get through. So if we don't want people transgressing the law, we build some extra laws that put it around the outside. So you have to stop work before the Sabbath, a half hour before the Sabbath, or things like that would be kind of categories that would fall in the hedge around the law kind of trend. Their view on sovereignty and responsibility is also what we'd call today Calvinistic. Their view on sources revelation, if you like, would be the Old Testament plus the oral tradition, okay? So they believed that Moses had given lots of other information at the time, and that was an oral tradition. So in that sense, they resemble Catholicism a little bit, that the Bible plus the tradition of the church, if you like, or even the papal statements. Obviously, the Pharisees had no person equivalent to the Pope, if you like. The Pharisees definitely believed in resurrection. Okay? Not so sure about the Essenes. Pharisees definitely did. They definitely believed in angels, But at least we don't hear about names of lots of angels or anything of that sort, so it don't seem to have had the emphasis that the Essenes did. And they believed in eschatology as well, but their emphasis more on the last judgment than on details of what might happen there. Well, that brings us down to the Sadducees. There's some argument where the name came from. Probably the commonest view is a suggestion it came from Hebrew tzedek, righteous. They were the righteous ones. Most groups, when they pick names for their own group, are favorable names, okay? So we call the Mormons the Mormons, but they call themselves the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. We call another group the Quakers. They call themselves the Friends, Society of Friends, okay? So they usually the group's own name is more favorable. Some people think maybe it came from Zadok, but don't know. The Sadducees were more pragmatic than even the Pharisees and tend to be somewhat compromising, and in that way they were able to work with whatever powers were around, so they got along better with the Roman government, etc. We think in terms of God's sovereignty and human responsibility, we'd have to call the Pharisees Arminians, okay? So big emphasis on human responsibility and human freedom, etc. What was the source of revelation? Origen, I believe it is, claims that they only held to the Pentateuch, but the evidence we've got suggests more the whole Testament. And they were suspicious of the oral tradition of the Pharisees, so at least of anything in a different tradition. And probably weren't into the Essene secret books either. And I think that probably fits better, the evidence we've got. What about resurrection question? The New Testament tells us they didn't believe in resurrection, but doesn't tell us what they did believe in. Josephus says they believe in no survival, okay? When you're dead, you do not exist anymore, okay? And that really fits better Jesus' response to them on this whole resurrection question than the idea that they believe, say, in the immortality of the soul or something of that sort. They apparently did not believe in angels, and we don't know exactly what that meant because we don't have any of their writings. Okay, whether it meant they believed angels don't show up today or something, or whether they believed that there never were and there's some other explanation. So you might say, how could they not believe in angels if they believed in the Old Testament? Well, theological liberals and Protestantism can believe in lots of things or not believe in lots of things that the Bible explicitly says are or aren't, and they don't go that way. Emphasis on eschatology. No, the Sadducees believed that since you don't exist after you die, there's no judgment. The judgment is in this life. If you're prosperous, God is favorable to you, and so they attracted, tended to be upper class, wealthy people, etc. Well, that's the theology quickly of these three groups, taking theology in a rather broad sense. What about their influence and survival? As far as we can tell, there weren't a lot of Essenes, and they tended to be withdrawn from society, so obviously not quite so able to have as much influence. The Pharisees, on the other hand, were popular, but not apparently an actually a large group. So they just were a very influential group. The Sadducees were even smaller than the Pharisees, certainly, and probably smaller than the Essenes as well, but they were the richest people and such. The Essenes, being withdrawn from society, were withdrawn from politics. The Pharisees had some influence politically, but they were dominant religiously. Josephus tells us that their way of reading things was the way that the people went, and the Pharisees, the Sadducees, took their life in their hands to oppose that too much. The Sadducees, however, were dominant politically, realizing that that meant they were under the Romans, so they couldn't do anything they wanted. Influence and survival of the Essenes, they wrote or copied the Dead Sea Scrolls. So their influence picks up again when they become known here in 1948. But there's some evidence that some of their scrolls were found in the early medieval period, so that we have a Jewish group that found some of those and decided that the oral tradition of the rabbis was wrong, and went the other way. Their name has slipped my mind at the moment. So maybe it will come back before I finish this section. The influence of the Pharisees and survival is pretty substantial. They survived the destruction of Jerusalem to become the dominant group among the surviving Jews, and their rabbinic literature is by the heirs of the Sadducees. So that's the material that has come to dominate Orthodox Judaism over the whole centuries. For the Sadducees, as far as we know, none of their known writings survive. We don't actually know the name of any of their writings, as far as I know, but none of the writings that survive from that period are known to be Sadducee. Some of them might be, but I say we don't know quite enough about them to say. The Essenes, Qumran was destroyed in 68, so in the middle of the Jewish War, and some Essenes survived. Some, in fact, were apparently at the last stand at Masada in 72, and some of their material shows up in the Cairo Genitsa, the place for hiding documents, old documents in the synagogue. What we call a Damascus document is pretty surely theirs, and a copy of that was found in the Cairo Genitsa about a century before, no, not that long, 70 years, 60 years before the discovery of the Dead Sea Scrolls. The Pharisaic group survived the destruction in AD 70 to dominate Judaism, and it looks like the Sadducees were more or less destroyed with the temple. So, not to say every last person was, but something in that direction. Well, our last category, Palestine under the Romans. That's actually our next to last category now that I think about it. From 63 B.C., to 135 AD, where we'll stop this discussion, but actually going on from there all the way up till the Muslims come in the 600s, is Palestine under the Romans. The Hasmonean dynasty ends in 63 BC. You remember Hyrcanus II and Aristobulus II had fallen out. Aristobulus had grabbed the throne, we might say. Hyrcanus had run for cover, had called on the Romans. Now the Romans intervene in the dispute, and they're able to put down Aristobulus, and Judea now loses much of its conquered territories. Hyrcanus is not made king, okay? He would have been king otherwise. He's made ethnarch, okay? Rulers of a people group, we might say, of Judea, although Judea at this time does include Idumea, Perea, Galilee, etc. So a demotion from king. This time period is characterized by what we might call the Roman peace, the Pax Romana, from about 30 BC when Augustus establishes control over the empire for about two centuries to about 170 AD. Two centuries of peace over the Roman Empire. That's not to say there weren't some revolts and such. Beginning with Augustine, great growth and prosperity of the Roman Empire reaches its peak in the 2nd century A.D. The Pax Romana is very important to the spread of Christianity. So we have this Roman peace over the whole area. Some other features related to the Roman rule that are important for the spread of Christianity: the Romans built impressive road system over that whole area. No extensive road system to match it until the development of the automobiles in the 20th century. And lack of national boundaries. I mean, there were obviously ethnic groups in here and there, but there was no need for passports or the ancient equivalents of that to go from place to place within the empire. So very important, humanly speaking, for the spread of Christianity. We should say a word about the Herod family, because they become important at this point. Haven't really heard anything about them before this, but it starts with Herod's father, whose name was Antipater. He was an Idumean, that is an Edomite, was an advisor to Hyrcanus II, and because Hyrcanus was rather mild-mannered and unambitious, Antipater appears to have been the power behind the throne. When the Romans took over, he was made procurator for Judea for aiding Julius Caesar. Procurator meant the fellow who was responsible for the emperor's affairs in a particular territory or country. Antipater, as would be characteristic of many rulers of one sort or another, made his own sons administrators under him. And those sons were Phasael, someone that probably very few of you have heard about, and Herod, who nearly everybody has heard about by this point. But Antipater is assassinated in 43 BC, and this leads to the rise of the Herod that we call Herod the Great, who is important from 37 BC to his death. I have down here 4 BC. There's some argument over that, but that's still the standard date currently, huh? With the death of Antipater, the Romans appoint Herod and Phasael joint tetrarchs of this territory. Tetrarch is another word. You can see arc on the end of it, ruler, and tet, four here, quarter. It was a term used for a sub-territory in something. So they were tetrarchs of Judea, I guess, Herod and Phasael, but the territory, as I say, included Galilee and Samaria and Idumea, as well as Judea. Well, just about this time, the Parthians from on the east end, just outside the Roman Empire, invade the eastern end of the Roman Empire, and they briefly take Palestine, and they kill Phasael. They capture Phasael, actually, and put him in prison, and Phasael bashes his head out to avoid, I don't know, a torture or something of that sort. Herod manages to flee and manages to make it to Rome in 40 BC. And the Senate there appoints him king of the Jews. That doesn't cost them a whole lot. And the idea is they found somebody who's pretty ambitious, and they will allow him to borrow a lot of money from various people. Doesn't get a you know, a big stipend from the Romans. The Romans were fairly cheap in operating their society. We won't go into that here, but he's allowed at least to borrow money. He's got this authority, if you like, from the Senate, and so he goes back and returns with an army and takes Jerusalem in 37 BC. He now becomes the king of the Jews, 40 in name, 37 in fact. There's a problem, though. The Romans, if you remember any of Roman history from this period, and you probably don't, I never had anything in school anyway at that point, with the assassination of Augustus, of a Julius Caesar, we have a triumvirate, and it's Mark Antony and the guy who's going to be called Augustus eventually, and Lepidus, I believe, is the third guy. And the eastern part of the empire is under Antony, and Antony is very much under the influence of Cleopatra, and Cleopatra would like Judea. So Herod's throne is very insecure until Antony and Cleopatra both commit suicide in 31 BC. And thereafter, he's in pretty good shape until his own death. However, he has terrible family troubles all during this period. He kills his favorite wife, Mariamne, who was a descendant of the Maccabees and gave him his, what should we say, his connection with the Maccabees, as because otherwise he's just basically an appointee of the Romans, if you like. And then in the course of time, he kills three of his sons. Two of them are sons of Mariamne, and he's afraid they're going to try and get the throne before he's ready to give it up. And don't know for sure whether he was right about that or not. And then he kills a third son who is jealous of the other two sons and got them killed and such. So it got so bad at one point that Augustus, commenting on Herod's kosher food activities, says it's safer to be one of Herod's pigs than one of his sons. And there's a little play in Greek between hous, pig, and huios, son. So that's the situation there. Well, Herod, however, does have some accomplishments. He is not called the Great because he murdered his wife and three sons or anything of that sort. He's called the Great because he ruled a very large territory. He refurbished the Jerusalem temple starting in 19 BC and through the rest of his life, and then going on to 66 AD, they were working off and on in that temple, and basically had just gotten it finished in time for its destruction in the after the Jewish revolt. He did a number of building projects elsewhere in Israel, at Caesarea on the coast, in Sebaste, which had been the city of Samaria earlier, etc. So if you go back to Jerusalem today and look at the archaeology, some of the most prominent ruins, at least that are above the surface, are often Herodian ruins of one sort or another. Some of the walls around the city of Jerusalem and the tomb of Abraham and such in Bethlehem. Is that the right? That's the right. Hebron. Thank you. Not Bethlehem, etc. Fall in that kind of category. The killing of Bethlehem's children, very explicit in the Gospel of Matthew, but although we don't have an explicit statement about that in the other historical records of Herod, it fits his character very much. I mean, he killed three of his own sons, and they would have succeeded to him, one or the other of them, but he was just unhappy that they wanted to succeed too fast, so you can see how a non-Herodian claimant to the throne, he would have considered very, very dangerous. Well, when Herod finally did die, he had prepared a will, which, however, had to be validated by Augustus in Rome. In his will, he specified that his son Archelaus would be king and would rule over the major port of his empire, and under his territory, and then Antipas would rule over Galilee and Perea, and Philip would rule over some of the area north of that, Iturea Trachonitis. And those guys headed off to Rome to get validation. Jesus has a parable about a nobleman who goes off to a far country to receive a kingdom in return, and that's something that would have resonated with his hearers because something of that very sort had happened just a little bit earlier. Archelaus has several people in the Herod family that oppose his becoming king, and so Augustus gives him the title of ethnarch, but will be turned into king if he does a great job. He doesn't do a great job, and so he gets deposed in about 10 years. The other two brothers, however, do a fairly decent job in their territories, and so Antipas rules to 39 AD, Philip rules to 34 AD, but Archelaus only to about 6 AD. Herod has two descendants besides these, grandson and great-grandson, I guess, who rule as well. These are descendants through Mariamne, and so, therefore through one or both of the sons who Herod killed. One of them is Herod Agrippa I, and he actually gets the title King of the Jews for a short period, 41 to 44 AD, but then dies, and his death is narrated for us in both Josephus and Acts. And then his son, Herod Agrippa II, who becomes a king but not king of the Jews. He's king of another territory, and he lives to about 100 AD. So that's the end of the Herod dynasty then, finally, at that point. Well, we do have one more section here I want to say a little word about. Well, it's actually two more sections. I never keep track exactly. Okay, yeah, two more sections. One rather important one for this period, the Roman rule, is messianic expectation at the end of the New Testament period. There was, for some reason, Josephus mentions it, Suetonius mentions it, Tacitus mentions it. There was a considerable excitement over the idea that someone coming from Israel would rule the world at about this time. So this was strong in the first century AD, was influential in the Jewish revolt, and my suggestion is it had something to do with Daniel's 70-week passage, that they probably didn't have enough information to know exactly when that ran out, but it was pretty clear it would run out in what we call the first century AD. I have a little discussion of that in a chapter called The Time of the Messiah in a book, Evidence of Prophecy. And I think there's also a research report up on our Hebrew website about that with the same title. Regarding messianic expectation at the end of the Intertestament period, what did the people expect? What kind of Messiah did they expect? What kind of person did they expect? Well, as we look through the material we've got, we see that the views change with time. The early extra-biblical materials on the Messiah picture the Messiah as being more than human, though it's there's no clear view of his deity in any of the extra-biblical materials. There's some even more than hints in the Old Testament itself, and obviously the New Testament goes that way. But the other material, extra-biblical material, seems to go into an angelic direction of some sort, but not much further than that. The later rabbinic material seems to tend to minimize the Messiah in one way or another. The Old Testament data regarding Messiah posed various paradoxes regarding the office, his activity, the type of coming, the type of being, etc. And I suggest that these are solved by the New Testament and by Jesus, their candidate, if you like, and have another article on that, the New Testament model of the Messiah, which goes by, I think it's the nature of the Messiah in this book, The Evidence of Prophecy, but New Testament model of the Messiah in our chapter that's on the IBRI website, the IBRI Research Report. We also find from the Intertestament period various views on the Messianic period. How would it relate to the time period we're living in now? How would it relate to the state after the resurrection and things of that sort? And it shows us that there's a certain sense in which the views of the Jews in trying to interpret what we call the Old Testament, the Hebrew Bible, regarding eschatology, have some similarity to the views of Christians today trying to interpret the New Testament regarding eschatology. One could even claim that their views of the Messianic period have a vague resemblance to all-mill, pre-mill, post-mill. They're not very close, okay, but something in that direction. For instance, the various views viewed the time period we're in, and they give the title This Age, and then the days of the Messiah, and then the age to come. And in some views of the end of the age, you had basically a messianic period only. So you have the this age and the time of the Messiah, and so you had some kind of a millennium, we might say, on earth, but not clear what would happen after that. Other views had a eschaton only, this age, the age to come, and so that would resemble in some way an amillennial position, if you like. But the commonest view was this age, the time of the Messiah, and the age to come, which would be now, the millennium, and the eternal state, if you like, and so would fit as kind of premillennial eschatology of some particular sort. The order of events, Jewish interpreters this time are basically taking all the Old Testament prophetic data that appears to be eschatological and trying to figure out how to sort it. It's a little bit like putting pieces together in a puzzle, but you don't have the picture, okay? You just got the pieces. So you look at the pieces and you say, does this piece have that color on it, and this piece have that, will they match, etc.? So it's a tougher job, and yet, as you see it put together, they pick up a lot of things that at least premillennial Christians would say they got right. They really saw stuff in the Old Testament that we might have only noticed in the New Testament or something of that sort. So, for instance, they saw that there would be certain signs preceding the end. There'd be moral decay. There'd be calamities. There'd be signs in heaven. There'd be a forerunner, okay? And then the Messianic kingdom would be established, and the Messianic kingdom would include the return of Israel from exile, where perhaps premillennialists today would say perhaps there's going to be substantial return first and then the millennium, but even in that view you generally feel there'll be some return after that as well. There'll be punishment of the nations, okay, and the Messiah will rule. And there was various views on what the Messiah would have to do with establishing the kingdom, whether it'd be established first and then he would be brought in, or whether he'd be involved in establishing it. And you even got into models where there were two Messiahs, one who would be establishing it and one who would actually rule. We're not going to go off there, and that's probably even post intertestament period anyway. Then there's the days of the Messiah, what we Christians would call the millennium, and variable features in that as put together by different interpreters. What would be the place of the nations? Would they be included in this, or would they be kind of under Israel, etc.? But usually the time of the Messiah was seen as marvelous in one way or another, more miraculous than this age, if you like. Length uncertain, and you have some going with 40 years, others going over 1,000. It was typically seen as ending with the rebellion of Gog and Magog. So that's interesting, that phrase, of course, shows up in Revelation, but it also shows up in Ezekiel. And so they're trying to do that. And then what about the age to come, what Christians would perhaps call the eternal state? They saw a resurrection, they saw a judgment, and they saw an eternal state of either punishment or reward. So in that way, similar to what we see here. Well, two more things to say a little bit about quickly here. The end of the Jewish state and Palestine after the fall of Jerusalem. Both Rome and Israel, and at least some of the Jews, contributed substantially to the end of the Jewish state. The Roman procurators who controlled Palestine from 86 to 66, except for the period of 41 to 44 when Herod Agrippa is in control, is not basically a very good time for Israel. It began with replacement Archelaus in 6, deposed at Jewish request for misgovernment, and so the Romans bring in then their governors called prefect or procurator. At AD 6, when this takes place, there's a revolt of the zealots regarding the census, and that was kind of a sign of things to come. The zealots will gradually grow stronger as the Roman-Jewish relations deteriorate over this 60-year period. Then, in about 40 AD, the Roman Emperor Gaius, better known to us as Caligula, has delusions of grandeur and orders that his own statue be erected in the Jerusalem temple. Fortunately, he dies before the order is carried out, but the Roman procurator at the time really risked his life in delaying that, and then Caligula got assassinated by people in Rome who were interested in other things anyway. The procurators continue, except for Herod Agrippa in 41 to 44, until the outbreak of the Jewish revolt. In general, the procurators did not understand the Jews. They were frequently antagonistic to the Jews. Anti-Semitism was fairly common in the Greco-Roman world and such. And they tended to aggravate conditions, and in that way, that strengthened the zealots who were against them. So the zealots became more popular, if you like, as the situation grew worse. The last two of the Roman procurators, Albinus and Florus, were especially wicked men. Well, that led to the first Jewish revolt in AD 66 to 73. It actually was started by an incident between the Jews and the Gentiles in Caesarea and was spread and fanned by the procurator and by the zealots to inflame the whole country. Initially, the moderate Jews were able to take leadership, and that's how Josephus got in, but gradually they lost out to the more radical zealots. The revolt ended in the destruction of Jerusalem and its temple, AD 70, and the Jewish state, and then the mopping up operation was completed with the fall of Masada in AD 73. Palestine after the fall of Jerusalem, run from 70 to 135, where we'll break off. one of the important figures here is Rabbi Yohanan ben Zakkai. he was in Jerusalem during the siege and realized that this was going to be a disaster. And so with connivance of his disciples, he pretended to get sick, and I think probably of some very contagious disease, and pretended to die, and they carry him out in a coffin, and since it's a contagious disease, nobody's going to look in the coffin. And once they get out of range of the walls, he gets out of the coffin and they flee to the Romans, etc. Yohanan got permission from the Romans to establish a rabbinic school and a Sanhedrin at the coastal city of Jamnia, Yavne, Old Testament name. And there he rebuilt Judaism without a state or temple along the lines of Pharisaism. And that will eventually lead to the codification of the oral law, the Mishnah, and then later the Talmuds. Around AD 90, the Jewish Christians are excluded from the synagogues by adding a curse on the Nazarenes to the synagogue liturgy somewhere 90 to 100 AD. And so after that point, there's obviously tension already between the Christians and the Jews over this question of whether Jesus is the Messiah or not, but that kind of splits things. So the Christian Jews are no longer worshiping with the non-Christian Jews. One last remark here in the in this time period, and that's the Bar Kokhba, or Second Revolt, in AD 132 to 135. The Jews at this point had lost their state, but there were still lots of Jews living in Israel, though a lot of them had been carried off as slaves, particularly those who were taken in Jerusalem. But we go on, 73 to 132 is almost 60 years, huh? And the Romans are preparing to build a pagan city on the site of Jerusalem. And it will be named Aelia Capitolina, Capitolina in honor of the chief gods of the Roman pantheon. And Aelia is the family name of Trajan, the Roman emperor at that time. And the Jews realize that if that happens, they aren't going to get Jerusalem back anytime in the foreseeable future. So one of the chief rabbis at that time, a Rabbi Akiba, recognized a fellow Simeon ben Kosiba, who was apparently willing to lead the revolt, as Messiah and fulfillment of the Numbers 24:17, a star will arise out of Jacob. So he comes to be known as Bar Kokhba, son of a star, kind of a play on his own name, Ben Kosiva. The revolt is initially successful. The Romans actually had controlled their empire with a very small army, and so it was spread all over the place. So when there was a revolt broke out, typically it was successful for a while until the Romans organized and brought their legions in. And that's what happened here, but it was eventually put down with very considerable slaughter. After that, the Jews were forbidden to come near Jerusalem except on the Day of Atonement. And after that, Jerusalem ceases to be a missionary religion. Well, I think that gives you kind of a tour, if you like, of the Jewish background running from the end of the Old Testament to up through, actually, past the end of the New Testament, to give you a little feel for what was going on in that time period. So, that's where we will stop then for today.
Oh, that was a long one.
That was a long one, yes. Yeah. But that's really the whole second unit, okay.
Oh, is that right?
So we've done two units out of 12.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.